blessing. So please welcome Reverend.
Thank you. It is an honor to be here and to speak to all of you this morning. I have to say, it feels like such a different context to be speaking here at Personal Theology than it does to be preaching in the service. So we'll see how different that feels as the morning unfolds. But thank you so much for inviting me to speak. I'm really looking forward to it. I also want to acknowledge that I'm leading the service at 11:15, so I'm going to need to leave here no later than 10:45 in order to be able to get things ready for that service. So, all right. So, for me, all theology is profoundly personal. Because if my theology isn't relevant to the life that I am living, to the life that we all are living, if our theology isn't rooted and reinforced by our lived experience, I really question what it is good for. So I suppose that my personal theology begins with my personal beginnings. So I was born on February 5th, 1983. Everybody do the gasp. I know there's a gasp coming. I was born to a 28-year-old woman who surrendered me to the care of the state of Maryland that same day. Now, in the 80s, closed adoptions were the norm, and though my birth records include some basic background information on both of my biological parents, I've never met them or pursued meeting them. So the story of my adoption is a really precious one in my family. As you can imagine, my parents had been waiting for 8 years on the list of potential adoptive parents, and they had met several children who they thought they might be able to adopt, only for those children to be adopted by other families. So it was a time of intense heartbreak and hopelessness for my parents, who before that point had experienced infertility that no one could explain. So my mother, after 8 years, both my parents kind of figured it just wasn't going to happen, and they were sad, but my mom thought, okay, I've got to throw myself into something new. You know, I need to have some focus for my life. And she started a master's degree in geology. She was a chemist by trade, and she was really interested in going into geology. And the first day of her first class of this program, my mom gets a phone call, and the secretary from the geology department comes running into the classroom and says, "Mrs. Grassel, the social worker's on the phone for you." So my mom goes home and calls the social worker back. And the social worker says, "Mrs. Grassel, we have a little girl here for you. This isn't a drill. This is the real thing. She has a cold. Are you sure you want to pick her up today, or do you want to pick her up when she's healthy?" And my mom said, "Are you kidding me?" So my parents didn't even have a crib yet. They had some things that they had collected over the years, but that was the story of my adoption, of how I came to be in their family. And it's one that my parents tell and retell with the same sort of love and gushiness that that I tell of my children's births. So it's a very dear story to me. Now, ever since I can remember, people who know about how I came to be my parents' daughter have been telling me that Providence made sure I found my way to my parents for a reason. That though I had different biological parents, God had always intended me for my adoptive parents. And I know that they mean well, but even from a very young age, I can remember wondering why God would take the time to find me a good home, but hadn't gotten to all of the other kids who were still in foster care. And thankfully, when I asked my parents about this, they told me simply how thankful they were to my birth mother and what a blessing I was in their lives. Nice and simple. I never resonated with the concept of a grand divine plan, but I'm grateful that my parents gifted me with this foundation of gratitude. And I'm grateful also that my wondering about why I was welcomed into a loving family, and so many others never would be, led me to develop a sense of responsibility, a sense of obligation to those less fortunate than I was. I should also share that even at a very young age, I felt a keen connection between the mystery surrounding my origins and the mystery of our collective origins. Somehow, not knowing the details about where I came from felt just like not knowing about where humanity and our consciousness and life and the universe have all come from. And sometimes I think I was drawn to religion so strongly because investigating the nature of reality, the nature of God, seemed somehow easier than finding out who my birth parents were. At least in religion, there weren't any laws keeping me from the answers that I yearned for. There weren't the same kind of bureaucratic barriers blocking my discovery efforts. So maybe that's why the language of the great mystery is so meaningful for me. My birth parents are as ephemeral and intangible to me as the concept of God is to a lot of the people I know. And yet, ephemeral as they might be, I am still bound in relationship to them, bound in relationship to the mystery of who they were, bound in relationship to their absence in my life. So as I grew older and I started becoming aware of what different people around me believed about God, I immediately understood when people would describe this God, whatever that was, as a creator, as a mystery, as something we will never be able to fully understand, yet as something with whom we are in relationship. Because whether the ultimate reality that shapes our lives has consciousness or not, whether it acts intentionally within history to impact people's lives or not, I am still bound in relationship to it. Christmas carols at my aunt's annual caroling party, occasional trips on Christmas and Easter to our neighborhood Methodist church or my Grammy's Southern Baptist church, and my mother's musings about ghosts and spirits and aliens were my only explicit exposure to anything even resembling religion as a young child. These experiences, coupled with my wonderings about the origins and purpose of life, led me to ask my parents a lot of questions. This may be familiar for some of you. Eventually, they figured that they could use some help finding answers that would satisfy me. So we started going to Cedar Lane Unitarian Universalist Church in Bethesda, Maryland, which coincidentally my father had gone to in the late 60s because they had a coffee house series for many years that a lot of teenagers in the area went to. So my dad said, "Oh yeah, my friends and I, we used to go party at that UU church in Bethesda. We should send her there." He had also been the boathouse director for a YMCA summer camp, a sleepaway camp, and he always said that the two groups that seemed to get the most out of camp, who really seemed to have the most fun, were the deaf kids and the Unitarians. So he felt really good sending me to the Unitarian church for my spiritual formation. Anyway, I had a really wonderful experience in religious education as a child at my church growing up. I can remember the first day that we went to my church. We had visited many different churches, so, you know, this wasn't my sort of first foray into religious community or seeking religious community. But I can remember if you've ever been to Cedar Lane, there's an upper parking lot and a lower parking lot, and the upper parking lot was already full. So we parked in the lower lot and entered in through the lower doors, which is the religious education floor. All of the kids go to classrooms. And at this time, there were about 450 kids in religious education at Cedar Lane. There were about 1,000 to 1,100 members of the church. It's a big church. And I can remember walking in the church, and I can remember seeing a water fountain at my level and thinking, wow, they want me here. And going to the bathroom, and the toilets were at my level, and the sinks were at my level, and really feeling like a place had been prepared for me. And that was a really profound experience as an 8-year-old, because there weren't a lot of spaces that were profoundly welcoming to me. So Also, church was a place that really embraced my questions, that didn't get annoyed when I kept asking questions. I think I exhausted my parents in the way that CJ is beginning to exhaust Christian and me in asking why all the time. So I really appreciated that environment to be able to do all of the exploring that my heart yearned to do. And the other thing is, there were lots of other adopted kids there. I wasn't the only other adopted kid, there was no other place in my life where that was true. So my experience in religious education taught me that our faith was one that assumed that symbolic words like God could and should have varied and fluid meanings for different people, and that our faith was distinct from many others because we didn't just tolerate the diversity of beliefs in our church, but we celebrated them. In our church, people were not supposed to have to leave part of who they were in terms of theology or culture, race or socioeconomic status at the door in order to be fully welcomed and valued. But as I began to get involved in church life beyond the religious education program, I noticed that there seemed to be tension around particular kinds of questions, tension around specific words for some of the people that I was getting to know. People would make jokes about that tension all the time. When's the only time you hear the name of Jesus Christ mentioned in the Unitarian Universalist Church? When the sexton slips with a hammer and hits his thumb. But very few people would ever talk about God or Jesus or Moses or Muhammad or the goddess in positive terms or in terms of their own convictions. And at the time, I found this, alongside of our incredible theological freedom, very confusing. Now, hypersensitive to all forms of hypocrisy, as many teenagers are, it began to dawn on me that there seemed to be different expectations for children and adults in church. While the children and youth of the church reveled in our spiritual freedom and rested in the assurance that the religious education community would celebrate us for who we were and any number of theologies we came to affirm, few of the adults outside of the RE program seemed to talk at all about what they believed or what they affirmed. They instead seemed content to focus only on what they rejected. And I heard adults that I admired call people who believed in God unintelligent and naive. And I wondered if they realized how naive they sounded, assuming that everyone who professes belief in God believes the same things about God. And so it became very clear to me that for many people in my home congregation, even though we had the freedom to define religious words very broadly and inclusively, for many those words still carried narrow and exclusive definitions. And as an impressionable youth who very much valued what the adults in my life thought of me, who very much wanted to hang on to the sense of being completely welcome in my congregation, this dissonance eventually led me to keep a lot of my questions and forming ideas about what I believed to myself. The dissonance I experienced in my congregation around what it meant to be a religious person and my need for help discovering some answers to my questions came to a head in a big way when my grandfathers died. They died in the span of a few short weeks, one to Alzheimer's and the other to suicide. And after the shock wore off, I was overwhelmed with trying to figure out why these terrible losses had happened to my family. I had known that they would both eventually die, but my mother's father had lived for years in an affordable nursing home way down in Georgia, far away from my Grammy and all of the family who loved him. Why had he had to suffer like that? And why did my dad's father, my opa, feel that he had to take his life? Why, if people are inherently good, as I had been taught in church, did he do this thing that hurt us all so much? I had never seen my father cry before. Never, ever. before his father died. But after his death, he cried every day for a while. And that actually, more than anything else, shook me to my core. Because if that could happen, it seemed like absolutely anything could happen. That there was no rhyme or reason or purpose to anything. That life was just chance and biology. And if that was true, what the hell was the point? And talking to my friends at school and church actually just made it worse. I had several friends tell me how sorry they were that my grandfather was in hell. Hell had never actually entered my mind as a possible reality before. But now that people were talking about it as a place one of my loved ones might actually be, I began to fear that he might be suffering on the off chance that their religions were right and mine wasn't. And while my friends at church were far more comforting in some ways, I grew more and more infuriated when the only answers anyone could give me when I asked why this happened were, "I don't know," or "sometimes there isn't a reason." In that time in my life, I needed something more than that. I needed something that spoke to my lived experience, that would meet me right where I was in the thick of trying to understand the classic problem of theodicy, or why a universe that is good would allow bad things to happen to good people. I needed some serious theology. And thankfully, when I visited one of the ministers of my home congregation, the Reverend Douglas Taylor, and told him how I was feeling, he gave me just that. He heard my questions about how a faith that assumes people are inherently good can in any way speak to those who have experienced sorrow or evil. He heard my terror that it was even a distant possibility that my opa might be damned to eternal punishment for what I was coming to believe was the result of the beginnings of dementia. My minister took my 16-year-old self seriously, and he gave me the great Hosea Ballou's Treatise on Atonement to read. Now, for those of you who are familiar with this seminal work, you know that even though it's a bit dense language-wise, it's not a long read. And I read it all in one night. And then I reread it. And then I reread it some more. In a nutshell, Ballou basically eviscerates the idea that a loving God would allow anyone to suffer infinite punishment for finite sin. He made a lot of points that resonated with me, that comforted me in the midst of my grief and pain and fear, but the idea that came to form the foundation of my personal theology was his argument that if we accept that sin can sentence a person to hell, we're basically saying we believe sin is greater than God. And in other words, contrary to what many religions teach, there is nothing we can do or not do to make us unredeemable. There is nothing we can do or not do that can render us undeserving of love, unworthy of saving. No one is left out. No one is forsaken. Ultimately, even if it takes a very long time, even if it takes longer than our lifetime, love wins. Every single time. And if we're all worthy of love in the end, then we must all be worthy of love here and now. It was through Ballou's universalist writings that I came to claim the heritage of Jesus and his ministry, and from there, the broader Unitarian and Universalist traditions as my own. Many Unitarian Universalists come to our faith by claiming atheism or humanism, having come from other religious roots. For me, it was actually kind of the other way around. I began in a humanist Unitarian Universalist congregation, and for me, it was by claiming our faith's Christian roots that I found a place for myself in the stream of our living religious tradition. Years later, I came across a piece of writing that my amazing colleague, humanist Unitarian Universalist minister Kendall Gibbons, wrote about the importance of the language of reverence. It pretty well sums up my experience claiming the poetic language and story of our Unitarian and Universalist heritages. She writes, "We ought to be about the business of re-examining and reclaiming the treasures of articulated reverence that star the landscape of human history. If for no other reason, for the sake of the children, we must otherwise raise in the spiritual vacuum of our own resentments. In the process, we might find ourselves improved in modesty and maturity, as well as vocabulary, and that in itself would be no bad thing." Now later, like many young adults, I rebelled in the usual ways, but also religiously and ideologically. I toyed with Catholicism and Marxism and Buddhism, and more so than anything else, I yearned for ritual and tradition with the depth of millennia, for glimpses of truth so eternal that the stories about it began before anyone even had a system for writing them down. In hindsight, I was in a very transient time in my life, claiming independence from my parents, even from the church and tradition of my childhood in some ways, so I think I was searching for a way to ground myself in something that felt solid, in something dependable and eternal. But through it all, my faith in the sovereignty of love, my conviction that love always wins, held me fast, and I returned to Unitarian Universalism a little older and a little wiser and a little more compassionate than when my heart had left it. I had always wanted to become a church music director. That's what I felt called to since I was 8 years old. Because that had been the entryway into my spiritual life. But I had had a series of terrible retail and recruitment jobs to try to save money for graduate school programs. And also, no matter how much I practiced, I just couldn't seem to improve my piano skills enough to pass the grad school proficiency test. But where one door seemed to be closing, another one was beginning to open. Now, I'd had a lot of calls to the ministry in my life, that I hadn't really connected yet, hadn't really seen in that way. My revelation about love's reign in the world and my desire to help others feel the relief and joy I'd felt upon experiencing it was only one call. I may have told the story before, I don't remember, but let's see. I'm trying to remember what year it was. It was in the 90s. It was the General Assembly in Nashville, Tennessee. And I was there as a youth delegate. And I don't know if you've been to Nashville before, but the homeless population in Nashville is gigantic. There are lots of homeless people. I think because it's such a warm environment, it's easier to eke out an existence there than it is in many other American cities if you don't have a place to live inside. So on our walk from the hotel to the convention center every day, we would experience homeless people asking us for money or asking us for help. And I'd been raised by parents who were very street savvy, who didn't even want me talking, you know, to anyone asking for help because muggings are common in D.C. And so, you know, we just kind of kept walking past people. We'd say hi, but we didn't give any money or anything. And then a few nights into General Assembly, we were heading out as a group, my friends and I, to the youth worship at night. And one of the men who had been asking us over and over again for money was laying in the street, and there was an ambulance there and a police officer calling in some code. And we didn't know if he had died or if he was just really sick. We had no idea. But that was a huge turning point for me in my life because that was the first time in my life I actually felt culpable for the situation that another person found themselves in. And so my friends and I went back to the youth hotel, had a good cry, and then talked about what we wanted to do in response to this experience that we had. And these were the days when they used to, in all of their wisdom, put all of the youth in one hotel. which I do not recommend for general assemblies. We did a lot of things that would not be good, that I would not recommend, wouldn't want my kids doing. But at that time, it was actually useful because we just started at the top floor. We had plastic grocery bags, and we went every door to door because the entire hotel was just UUs. There was nobody else there. It was just a youth hotel. We went door to door and collected people's spare change. We had these huge bags of spare change. So we walked the, mile and a half to the closest Kroger grocery store, gave them all of our coins, and thank God they had one of those coin machines there, and, we found out how much money we had, and we went and we bought a whole bunch of food and bottled water. And believe it or not, these were the days before the internet. So we found a payphone, and we found the phone book, and we started looking up nonprofits, relief organizations. And the only one that we could find that we could get through to on the phone was the Baptist Mission. And they had a food pantry and a soup kitchen, and we thought, okay, they'll be able to use this. So we took the food there. And then the next day, a newspaper reporter got wind of this and came and interviewed us and asked us why we did it. And in my youthful, sarcasm, exuberance, I said, well, we just wanted to show the adults at General Assembly that you can get something done without forming a committee. And he put that in the paper. So John Buren's current president of the UUA found us the following day and found us in the exhibit hall, and he's like, so yeah, this is really great. Also, could you give us a heads up before you give interviews to newspapers so that we know what's going on, so that if people ask us about this thing that you've done, we know that you've done it. So anyway, he brought us in front of the whole plenary session on the last day of General Assembly and said, we got to tell the story of what had happened, and then they took a collection, an extra collection, and they set the money aside to be seed money for youth who wanted to do projects to benefit the local communities where GA would be held in the future. And that was really my first experience of feeling like people responded to me as a leader, not just, I wasn't just sort of one of the workers on the line, but that I was really being affirmed in my leadership. And that was really, it took years for me to really process that because, as a woman, as a young woman, I wasn't often looked to as a leader, in my community. So that, along with a lot of other stories like that, I came to see as calls to the ministry. And in the midst of trying to figure out what I was supposed to be doing with my life, all of these separate experiences of being affirmed, all of my memories of being far more curious about spirituality and philosophy than anyone else I knew, began to make a sort of sense when I imagined myself as a minister. And when I started telling people, very cautiously, that I was thinking of going into the ministry, the most common response became, oh, well, of course you are. So I let go of the music director I thought I was going to become, and I opened myself to being shaped by the possibilities ahead of me in ministry. While I explored several different theological schools, including the UU ones, I settled on Wesley in Washington, D.C., because it was close to my family and because my home church had just given me a job doing membership work, and that church was 25 minutes away. And it was there in seminary where I began to add to my core theology that love wins. I remember being in my very first Hebrew Bible class in seminary and reading the story of when Moses goes up the mountain to see God face to face. And when he asks God what God's name is, God responds, "I will be what I will be," which just makes me laugh every time. Now, I approach the Bible as a collection of stories that contain truth, even if they don't recount historical fact. Yet in this story, I found a resonant way to think about God as the principle of becoming. the energy always at work in the world, bringing the new and the possible and the good and the just to birth. I later came to discover that this was basically a process theology perspective. And that's how I came to discover the work of process theologian Bernard Loomer, who I'm told, who I'm told helped create this very personal theology series I'm speaking for today. Isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
I think that's so great. So it's a particular honor not only to be part of this series, but to be a co-minister of the church where one of my theological heroes made such a lasting impact. So thank you. And it's actually with Loomer's work that I want to begin talking about the second part of what I want to share with you all today. And that is my conviction that growing deeper liberal faith is the most important work that we as a community can do for our hurting world today. Loomer wrote a lot about spiritual growth, you may know, and what that process is and how it can change the people who pursue it. I particularly resonate with the very physical images he uses to talk about this inner or spiritual growth. He writes, he used to talk about the size of your heart and growing the size of your heart and your soul. And he would when he would write the word size, he would write S-I-Z-E to try to give a sense of the expansiveness. So he says, by size, I mean the capacity of a person's soul, the range and depth of his love. Sorry about the gendered language. His capacity for relationships. I mean the volume of life you can take into your being and still maintain your integrity and individuality. The intensity and variety of outlook you can entertain in the unity of your being without feeling defensive or insecure. I mean the strength of your spirit to encourage others to become freer in the development of their diversity and uniqueness. I mean the power to sustain more complex and enriching tensions. I just love those words. I don't know about you, but I can't think of a time when the world has needed more people who can sustain more complex and enriching tensions. Am I right? I can't think of a time when our country has needed the kind of open, affirming, holy, justice-oriented perspective that liberal religion has to offer. As representatives in the House and Senate begin to dismantle the social programs and democratic structures that have helped our country grow in equity for generations, I can't imagine that there could be any moment but now for us to proudly, openly, with the strength of our convictions, call America toward a new moral revolution. In an article he wrote just a couple of weeks ago, senior Think Progress religion reporter Jack Jenkins argues that President-elect Trump's rise is, quote, paving the way for a revival of the religious left. I couldn't agree more. And I believe that this is central to our calling as a community in the foreseeable future. Jenkins writes, when Trump's administration in waiting again flirted with the idea of a Muslim registry, it was a band of Christians, Jews, and Buddhists who stood in front of the nation's mosque in Washington, D.C. to declare that they would happily register as Muslims in solidarity. And within a week of Trump's election, the American Jewish Committee and the Islamic Society of North America forged a historic alliance known as the Muslim-Jewish Advisory Council to develop a coordinated strategy to address the anti-Muslim bigotry and anti-Semitism in the United States. In short, the more Trump and his supporters target progressive people of faith and their allies, the more those people band together and the louder their voices appear to become. He later writes, to be sure, the religious left is unlikely to match the power and influence that the religious right has enjoyed. I'm sorry, did I say that right? The religious left is unlikely to match. Okay, thanks, you're with me. Although a sizable group, progressive people of faith probably lack the membership numbers required to mimic that kind of political machine. And while the various flavors of liberal theology are arguably more prescient now than in decades, it may not capture the hearts of many conservatives. Still, the United States has a long history of embracing ethical exemplars in times of crisis. As such, the left wing of America's faithful is well positioned to offer a more progressive religious vision for the millions of Americans dissatisfied with the incoming administration. The precise dimensions of this vision are still being defined, but Barber offered a none too subtle hint at its focus in a sermon delivered shortly after the election. The role of the church is to engage in the dangerous ministry of telling the truth, he said. May the truths about ourselves, our systems, our institutions, our habits, our faith, our potential, our possibility, guide all of our feet. May we engage our call as truth tellers with courage, and may we keep the faith that somehow, even if we can't yet see how, even if it takes a long time, hate will not have the last word. Love wins. Thank you.
So we have a wonderfully large crowd today. There's probably lots of questions. Please make sure that you keep your questions short and to the point so that we can get to as many people as possible. So,
can I ask a question? I've never been to one of these before. Am I responding to the questions, or
yes,
are they questions for discussion? Okay, thanks. I didn't know.
You're still in the hot seat.
Oh, that's fine.
Although sometimes it does open up into discussion.
Does anyone mind if I sit in a chair and use this microphone to answer questions? I just know I'm going to be standing for the rest of the next service, too.
We'll use this microphone to move around because we're recording this.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Great.
But feel free to sit. So who wants to go first?
Thank you. Oh, thank you.
There has to be a question in here somewhere.
Oh, fine. Thanks. There you go.
This is not a question. It's a request. I hope, Kristen, when the questions are over.
Is it on?
Okay, like this. All right. All right. So, Kristen, this is not a question. It's a request, and I'm hoping that when the questioning is over, you would sing us a song.
Okay, I can do that.
Great.
Quick, ask me another.
Well, that was nice, right? Who's next?
Can you spell the name of the man you referred to, Loomer?
Yeah, Bernard, and then Loomer is L-O-O-M-E-R, correct? Is that? Yeah, okay.
And I have a similar question of Barbara, who was that one that
William
you...
Barber.
Oh, William Barber.
Yeah, I'm
oh,
sorry.
Oh, William Barber. Okay,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, the pastor from North Carolina who has been leading the Moral Mondays.
Yeah. And the Third Reconstruction.
And the Third Church Reconstruction. Right, the church isn't dying, the church is reforming. Yeah.
Hi, I was a delegate at UU Nashville, et cetera, during the General Assembly. Mm-hmm. And I just can tell you that we were totally awed by what the youth had done and the youth power, et cetera. So it's really very exciting, and I didn't know of that connection, but I'm thinking, I think we picked the right people, and I want to salute our search committee. Thank you.
So the really cool thing about that experience is there were a core of five youth who really led that charge, and every single one of them is either a minister or otherwise a church staff member. So,
So you spoke earlier to our convictions that we have. Mm-hmm. And what I'm really struck by after this election and so many other elections, it seems like so many citizens in this country lack any convictions at all.
Preach it. What,
they vote one way 4 years, and 4 years later they vote the opposite way, and down to the wire they're undecided. Even when the choice is very clear, they can't figure it out. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to deal with that almost.
I really think that has, I don't know, I think anything that I would offer is just conjecture. You know, I'm not sure that I have an answer for that. But what I wonder about that is the impact that the alternative news machine has had on people's sense of what is true. And I think it's really easy to lose a sense of conviction or a sense of strength around one's beliefs when it's hard to know what is true anymore in the world. So.
Hi. So you spoke about when you saw that homeless man on the street, and you all went back and you cried first, and then you went out and you did something. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if you have any other personal rituals or things that you do to release feelings or emotions that aren't serving you. I mean, I hear you saying releasing by crying and by doing something about it. Is there any, just wondering if there's any other rituals that you have you could share with us?
You know, it's really funny you say that, because the service at 11:15 is all about releasing our anger and grudges and resentments and whatever is holding us back from being who and what we're called to be. So stay tuned for that. Also, I work out. I cook. I have a prayer practice that sometimes can more be characterized as yelling at God when I get really mad about what's happening in the world. So I really resonate with the tradition of lament in the Hebrew Bible, and I think that's something that we don't lift up enough in religious life, that we're allowed to get pissed off at the way that things are. I think we're not paying attention if we don't get pissed off at the way things are. But you're right. That's a starting point, not an end point. And it's not healthy to be a vessel for that. You know, I want to be a vessel for love and justice. So.
So yesterday I was at the Democratic Party elections.
Thank you.
There were people all over the state, progressives all over the state, who kind of took over. And I've seen some interesting organizing based on progressives calling outside our own little bubbles into places like the South, or into places where somebody mentioned people feel very isolated. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if that might be a periodic thing that we might do to have conversations across differences, but to reinforce some of those folks that maybe you know in other parts of the country, not necessarily in our district, not necessarily UU, but people we really need to be in conversation with. And possibly people who are of progressive values to reinforce those and energize them.
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. It was interesting when I was preparing to go to my internship, and a lot of people at my home church were like, oh my God, you're going to Texas? Oh my God. You know, they were really concerned for me. And, you know, were like, there's Unitarians down there? Like they kind of couldn't believe it. And I got down there, and it was actually, it was a profound experience for me to do liberal religion in a very conservative area. I mean, Joel Alstein's church was not that far from the church where I was serving. And a lot of the assumptions that I had about who our allies in that place would be were really challenged. I was surprised by how much common ground we had with a lot of the Catholic churches in Houston, because while many of the conservative evangelical churches are totally, they sort of take the gospel of getting, you know, closing our immigration and making, you know, America great again and that kind of thing. The Catholic churches are not. they're very focused on social justice and on you know what they believe in, and we did a lot of work around how we as a liberal religious community could be in relationship with them, and also with the Houston congregation had an Islamic center build a new Islamic center just behind their lot, and we shared a driveway, you know, access and everything. And it was I was part of the original conversations with the imams there to talk about wanting to make sure that we could work together, and acknowledging that there were lots of things that we didn't agree on, but that there were lots of things we did agree on, and that we could do things together. And that congregation, the two congregations are now offering English as a second language together. Like, they're doing incredible ministry together in their community. So, but I also want to just lift up that the conservatives in the South and in Texas are not, sorry, the Unitarian Universalists and other religious liberals in conservative areas know what they're doing. Like, they're very familiar with their context and how to be effective. And talking to my mother-in-law, who was vehement Democrat from Austin, Texas. She is the woman you don't ever want to get on your bad side if you're in government in Austin, because she will come to every meeting, and that's just who she's great. She's really, I need to take a page out of her book. But she gets so frustrated when she hears people sort of characterize all of Texas as one way. She's like, excuse me, I've been here, you know, fighting for justice for years. So I think that's really good to lift up. And I do think that there are resources that we have, and there are things that we are able to do and issues we're able to speak out on that maybe our siblings in faith and other places can't, and that there are ways that we can support one another. Thank you.
I'm tempted to comment on the South issue because I was at an event where Reverend Barber spoke day before yesterday for attorneys calling us to come to the South and to support what's going on in the South. And so I love the idea of the congregation potentially trying to do that. Mm-hmm. But also drawing on what you just said, it seems to me that we have a lot to learn about how to talk about our faith and how to encourage people to participate. I know we're not supposed to proselytize exactly, but I feel like there's good news to share.
Absolutely.
And maybe we are supposed to proselytize. There's no rule, right? But I'd like to know from you, as both a younger person and also someone who's lived in the South and who's really worked on the conversation with people, how you approach talking about UUCB, encouraging people to join us.
That's a good question. I draw a pretty distinct line between proselytizing and evangelizing. The word evangelizing literally means sharing the good news. That is the literal definition of that word. Proselytizing is trying to convert people. But, you know, telling someone how wonderful dinner was at a new restaurant isn't the same thing as trying to pressure them to go with you to that restaurant. You know, like, there's a big difference between those two things. One of them is attractional, and the other one is coercive. Right. And I think we can all agree that we're not interested in coercion. As a liberal religious tradition, that's not how we believe transformation really happens. But I absolutely think that we have an obligation to share with the world how we have been changed by our experience in liberal religious community, because there are so many people who don't even know it exists. You know, there's so many people. So, and that's our fault, you know, that really is. And I think that we worry a lot, maybe too much, about offending people by just being open that we go to a church and that we like it and, you know, that kind of stuff. Like, I think we're allowed to say that. I don't think that that's, like, impolite or inappropriate. So, So it's funny you should say that because we're making friends in our Pinole neighborhood. It's always good to have friends outside the church. and right now we're making friends with people who have children the same age as our kids. And it's so funny. I met, two other moms for coffee, the day before New Year's Eve. And, and the subject of, I forget what I said. I was complaining about Trump, I'm sure. And they both said, okay, so we have to tell you something. They were like, when we first met you and then we found out you were ministers, we were really weirded out and we didn't know if we were going to be able to be friends. And I was like, you didn't know if you would be able to be friends with us? Like, that's a little ridiculous. But they said, no, you know, like we haven't really met people who are ministers or who understand themselves to be religious, who we felt we had anything in common with. And I said, well, that's really unfortunate because there's a whole lot of people who I think you have a lot in common with who go to our church. And I just left it at that. But I think those are the kind of conversations that we can have that can at least plant seeds for people for whom maybe later in life when they experience a loss or, you know, are in a transition period or whatever. I mean, that's usually what brings people into church in the first place is something has gone wrong. They're looking for something. And so at least making sure people know that we exist and where we are, we owe it to our community, I believe.
Hi, Kristen.
Hi.
I wanted to thank you because it when you said about Texas and how people get this idea that it's conservative. I remember when we were reforming the group from the youth group from LRY to YRUU, there was a large, powerful delegate, whether GA or youth, who were from that area and areas like Knoxville and North Carolina and those areas. So I wanted to thank you for that. The question that I have is I think you have something similar. I was always a very, very liberal, hardcore Democrat, and I had several experiences where I had to look at someone who was conservative or to the far right and get similarities. Have you ever had those experiences?
Oh, yeah. My best friend, actually, her husband works for the NRA, and he is pretty conservative in a lot of ways. I have a lot of family members who are very conservative. I have one family member in Maryland who didn't send her children to public school because she feared for their souls if they would go there. I think many of us have family and neighbors and friends like that, and it is challenging, I think, to be really open and courageous with our convictions about what is right and true, because those things are life and death for a lot of people in our country. Like, this isn't just a matter of, like, stepping on someone's emotional toes, you know. This is a matter of life and death for immigrants, for people of color, for women, you know, with our reproductive rights coming under threat. So I think, it's an ongoing challenge to balance, you know, feeling an obligation to stand up for what's right and trying to retain a sense of relationship. But I feel like hanging on to the thread of relationship is really important, sometimes more important than anything else, because it's through those relationships that change happens. Like, you're far less likely to be changed by someone you can't relate to or you have no context with, but, like, you know, change can happen over years with constant exposure to someone who has different ideas. And thank goodness, I took pastoral care classes and have done a lot of work around where my job ends and where God or the Spirit or inspiration's job and the next person's job begins in terms of making change, because it's not my job to change anybody's mind. It's my job to be who I am, to be clear about what I think is right and true and why. And then it's the job of the other, of inspiration, of God, of whatever word you want to call that process of change and transformation, to change that person's heart. So hope that's helpful.
Hi. I'm absolutely thrilled to hear you talk about interfaith and working with other congregations at the foot of Mosher near San Pablo. San Pablo is St. John the Baptist, which is, I think, a very powerful church in Grip. I took you to meet Grip and, and what goes on there, the Greater Richmond Interfaith Program. Another church is Easter Hill on Cutting. And Pinole United Methodist near you. Those are all wonderful churches to work with, and I'm delighted. I think the future is interfaith. We can't do it alone. And
absolutely,
we do need to reach out to other congregations. So thank you. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Hi, Diana. I just like to comment on spreading the good word and say that at the bookstore here, we have a small book called, I believe, The Handbook of Unitarian Universalism.
The little blue one?
Yeah. And for sale there. And I think Peter Morales either edited it or wrote it. Anyway, it's just very helpful for clarifying who, for maybe stimulate your thinking about who we are as Unitarians, and that makes it easier to talk with people.
Your hands over here.
Just briefly, I want to say that Friday night at the ceasefire walk, we started at St. Mark's, which is way down in the middle of Richmond. And there were about five or six of us, all almost all UUs. And we were ready to start out when Father Romero came down. They were having an informal service, I think. He came all the way down the front of the aisle and spoke to one of the members and said, if you wait 5 minutes, I'll have more people to walk with you. He went back and spoke to the congregation in Spanish, which I don't understand. 120 people walked with us from that congregation. So there are ways to connect with people we may not agree with theologically, but have a really, really heart-to-heart connection with, and we need to do more of that.
Amen. That's awesome. Thanks for reporting back.
That's the subject of my question. I have a dream. I've been, ever since I joined this congregation, mainly because it was so tolerant to all religious views. I've had a dream that a Republican can walk through the door and feel comfortable here. Whenever I mention it to other people in the congregation, their eyes glaze over. There's a lot more vulnerable groups who we should be welcoming. Other races, other Muslims, other countries, people we could be protecting. Why am I so gung-ho about Republicans? I just don't want us to be a part of the polarization. And I feel that there is, in our very sense of identity, there are barriers to anyone who calls himself a Republican feeling comfortable for even a moment here. And I was wondering if there's something or anybody else who feels like we could work on this.
Go ahead.
My closest friends here are Republicans, and I think I'm grateful for you bringing that up. We just need to think about that. But there are... Yes, actually, two of them are dead now, but...
I'd like to respond to that. there was a lot of political diversity in the Houston congregation where I served. There weren't as many Republicans. There were a lot of libertarians who were members of that congregation, which is, there are a lot of libertarians in Texas, so that wasn't really a surprise. But and so I really began exploring this question, and one of my friends and colleagues, Tom Shade, who used to be the minister of our congregation in Worcester, Massachusetts, he and I were in a study group together for a while, and he's written extensively on his blog about sort of trying to unpack the relationship between liberal politics and ideology and liberal religion. And he has sort of come to a conclusion that that I agree with, which is that we, the free church tradition, the liberal religious tradition, is not taking its cues from the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has just begun to catch up with the morality of the liberal religious church that we have had for over 150 years. So, and that is just, to me, it's just read, you know, just look at the history of our free church tradition, not just Unitarian Universalism, but the Congregationalists, Reform Judaism, the Ethical Society. Like, if you look at the most liberal and progressive religions, you can see that the morality of the social gospel that sort of made us really fiery around the turn of the 20th century, that the Democratic Party has begun to align itself with those values. So I don't really... I think that many people should feel welcome in our congregations. I think that assuming why someone is a member of a certain political party is always a dangerous thing to do, because there are lots, it's just like assuming you know what someone means when they say they believe in God, or assuming you know what someone means when they say they don't believe in God. That these things are a matter of nuance, and there's a lot of symbolic language that's used. But I'm not going to, I am not going to tone down speaking truth in order to not hurt someone's feelings who maybe, you know, I feel like our current political milieu is so dangerous in a life and death way for so many people that I don't have the luxury of not being honest about that because I might hurt someone's feelings. Like, church isn't meant to be comfortable. It's not. It's not. Church, we are not here to be comfortable. We're here to be changed and to change. So...
Kristen, I found one of the most poignant statements you made in your kind of odyssey was your reflection about how all the young people at Cedar Lane were wrestling with theological questions and the adults scarcely ever talked about theology at all. And my question to you is, well, first of all, some reflections maybe on why that dialogue doesn't happen at a vital and engaging level. But the ancillary question is, how much does our spirituality, or how much does our social action suffer because of lack of theological clarity? And that doesn't mean uniformity, but individual clarity about theological grounding as a means of deepening our commitment to social action.
That is a really good question. I need a minute. Golly, I don't know if I can respond to that. That's a really good question, a hard question. Do you have any thoughts? Yeah, no. Right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that... I think I've always been so grumpy about that, that when, you know, it's so, like, a lot of people in our, in the UU world say things like, oh, it doesn't matter what you believe, it just matters what you do. And that makes me really grumpy because what you believe shapes what you do. They're not unconnected at all. And I get the whole idea of not sort of being too systematic in our theology, that, that systematics can be limiting. But, you know, what we believe impacts what we do and what we feel obligated to do or what we feel a sense of responsibility to do. And so a lack of clarity about what our convictions are can provide a lot of roominess for avoiding things and avoiding having to face things. And I think our culture trains us from a very young age to be extremely good at avoiding things, avoiding truth, like, you know, institutional racism, like we learned about yesterday at the workshop. And as I think I mentioned a little bit before, I think that our culture really trains us to, or what's happening right now with the false news, the alternate news. To me, this is not happening by chance. I really think a lot of this is being orchestrated intentionally to try to confuse people, because confused people can't act, you know, together. And frankly, their efforts are pretty darn effective right now. You know, the left is currently stabbing one another in the back, arguing about why Bernie, you know, didn't get elected. And, you know, it's like I find it just so frustrating that we can't get traction and move forward and start thinking about how we want to try to reintroduce real morality into this country. So I'm just going to note that I have about 5 more minutes.
It's a fascinating discussion. I noticed that there is still a group that is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And how are you ever going to change it unless you have a dialogue with them?
Mm-hmm.
And my comment about that is, I don't care what you know mm-hmm. until I know how much you care.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't want to look at people as different. I want to meet people personally.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep listening to this conversation, and I keep hearing this, like, I'm only going to talk to people that are right. That, mm-hmm. That's my comment.
And I think that that has been a real struggle for progressives and liberals for a long time. There's this sense of, like, you know, how pure can we be? Like, you know, trying to out-liberal, like, the next person. And I experienced it a lot when CJ was a baby and, like, would go to mom's groups and people would give me the stink eye for giving my kid non-organic Cheerios for a snack. You know, it's like I wasn't, you know, liberal enough or whatever. And I think that cripples us, and I think it turns people away.
2 more questions.
I'm going to teach you all a song.
At the risk of changing the focus a little bit, I want to ask a question that's a little more theoretical, but I have a conviction that it actually comes back in the end to be practical, but that's a long story. And it has to do with teasing out what you mean when you said love wins in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you have a theology, a cosmology view about what love is, because my sense is love is a human factor, and eventually our star is going to burn out, and eventually this planet is going to be no longer. And do you think love wins out in the very end, or just in humankind?
I've done a lot of thinking about that question, actually. You know, what is love? What Which, of course, brings into the question, I mean, this is sort of where I get into postmodernism, because, you know, during the modernist era, of course, everyone was really focused on trying to define, objectively define things and, you know, discover the historical Jesus and trying to really hunt down all of the factual information. Like, that was the era of the Jesus seminar, when people actually thought that they would be able to figure out what Jesus, the words Jesus actually said in the Gospels, as if, like, somehow that would be, I don't know. To me, that's just not that important. But so for me, you know, trying to understand what something like love is calls into question how dependable our senses are and our perception is. Because if anything, you know, as we've seen the development of science and mathematics and technology, a lot of times the way that we perceive things is not the way that they are. And so I've always had a bit of skepticism about human perception and whether that's something that we can really rely on as much as we might like to or want to. And I've always been really curious about the nature of consciousness, as I mentioned before, that I question what consciousness is. And there doesn't seem to be much of a biological answer for what that is and why some mammals have it and some don't. You know, why are there different kinds of consciousness? You know, is the, just like we can only see certain colors within the spectrum, are there only, does the Earth as a planet have a kind of consciousness that we don't even have access to understanding because of our limited nature? Do animals have a different kind of consciousness? Are they existentially aware of their own existence? You know, it seems like some of the primates, you know, are, because they're able to make tools and do preparatory things, and some other animals are. And so I'm really curious what consciousness is, and just because it's something that we can't remember prior to our current experience of life, does that mean that we weren't a part of consciousness before we were born? Does that mean that we're not a part of a kind of consciousness after we die? To me, it's all gloriously questionable, and I like that, and I like that I don't know, and I, again, for me, this all goes back to the mystery. And so I don't know what love is, other than it's something that I experience and something that saves me, and something that I know has saved people that I love, and something that that is rooted in generosity and charity. And I feel like I'm starting to ramble here. I hope that's helpful.
Time for a song.
Okay, everybody stand up, please. So I was going to teach you one song, but I just learned that longtime and beloved church member Royal Foote died this morning. So let me see here. Why don't we sing him? Why don't we sing Go Now in Peace for him, to whatever comes after this life, as he transitions into whatever it is that comes after this life. Okay, so let's sing Go Now in Peace. Go now in peace, go now in peace. May the spirit of love surround you everywhere, everywhere you go.